Chapter 6. Anybody entertaining an honest conviction of the inutility and bad effects of capital punishment in the abstract, founded on inquiry and reflection, without being the victim of a kind of effeminate feeling, without staying to inquire what there may be that is especially manly and heroic in the advocacy of the gallows, or to express my admiration of Mr. Calcraft, the hangman, as doubtless one of the most manly specimens now in existence, I would simply hint a doubt, in all good humor, whether this be the true Macaulay way of meeting a great question. One of the instances of effeminacy of feeling quoted by Mr. Macaulay, I have reason to think, was not quite fairly stated. I allude to the petition in Tall's case. I had neither hand nor part in it myself, but, unless I am greatly mistaken, it did pretty clearly set forth that Tall was a most abhorred villain, and that the House might conclude how strongly the petitioners were opposed to the punishment of death, when they prayed for its non-infliction even in such a case. The spirit of chivalry in Westminster Hall, of all the cants that are canted in this canting world, wrote Sterne, "Kind heaven defend me from the cant of art. We have no intention of tapping our little cask of cant, soured by the thunder of great men's fame, for the refreshment of our readers. Its freest draft would be unreasonably dear at a shilling, when the same small liquor may be at for nothing, at innumerable ready pipes and conduits. But it is a main part of the design of this magazine, to sympathize with what is truly great and good, to scout the miserable discouragements that beset, especially in England, the upward path of men of high desert, and gladly to give honor where it is due, in right of something achieved, tending to elevate the tastes and thoughts of all who contemplate it, and prove a lasting credit to the country of its birth. Upon the walls of Westminster Hall, there hangs, at this time, such a something, a composition of such marvelous beauty, of such infinite variety, of such masterly design, of such vigorous and skillful drawing, of such thought and fancy, of such surprising and delicate accuracy of detail, subserving one grand harmony and one plain purpose, that it may be questioned whether the fine arts in any period of their history have known a more remarkable performance. It is the cartoon of Daniel Maglies, executed by order of the commissioners, and called the spirit of chivalry. It may be left an open question whether or no this allegorical order on the part of the commissioners displays any uncommon felicity of idea. We rather think not, and are free to confess that we should like to have seen the commissioners' notion of the spirit of chivalry stated by themselves, in the first instance, on a sheet of foolscap, as the ground plan of a model cartoon, with all the commissioned proportions of height and breadth. That the treatment of such an abstraction, for the purposes of art, involves great and peculiar difficulties, no one who considers the subject for a moment can doubt. That nothing is easier to render it absurd and monstrous, is a position as little capable of dispute by anybody who has beheld another cartoon on the same subject in the same hall, representing a ghoul in a state of raving madness, dancing on a body in a very high wind, to the great astonishment of John the Baptist's head, which is looking on from a corner. Mr. Maglies's handling of the subject has by this time sunk into the hearts of thousands upon thousands of people. It is familiar knowledge among all classes and conditions of men. It is the great feature within the hall, and the constant topic of discourse elsewhere. It has awakened in the great body of society a new interest in, and a new perception and a new love of, art. Students of art have sat before it, hour by hour, perusing in its many forms of beauty, lessons to delight the world, and raise themselves, its future teachers, in its better estimation. Eyes well accustomed to the glories of the Vatican, the galleries of Florence, all the mightiest works of art in Europe, have grown dim before it with the strong emotions it inspires. Ignorant, unlettered, drudging men, mere hewers and drawers, have gathered in a knot about it as at our back a week ago, and read it, in their homely language, as it were a book. and mines, the roughest and the most refined, it has a like found quick response, and will, and must, so long as it shall hold together. For how can it be otherwise? Look up, upon the pressing throng who strive to win distinction from the guardian genius of all noble deeds and honorable renown, a gentle spirit, holding her fair state for their reward, and recognition, do not be alarmed, my lord chamberlain. This is only in a picture, and say what young and ardent heart may not find one to beat in unison with it beat high with generous aspiration like its own in following their onward course, as it is traced by this great pencil. Is it the love of woman, in its truth and deep devotion, that inspires you? See it here. Is it glory, as the world has learned to call the pomp and circumstance of arms? Behold it at the summit of its exaltation, with its mailed hand resting on the altar where the spirit ministers. The poet's laurel crown, which they who sit on thrones can neither twine, or wither, is that the aim of thy ambition. It is there, upon his brow, it wreathes his stately forehead, as he walks apart and holds communion with himself. The palmer and the bard are there, no solitary wayfarers now, but two of a great company of pilgrims, climbing up to honor by the different paths that lead to the great end. And sure, amidst the gravity and beauty of them all, unseen in his own form, but shining in his spirit, out of every gallant shape and earnest thought the painter goes triumphant. Or say that you who look upon this work, behold, and bring to it gray hairs, a head bowed down, a mind on which the day of life has spent itself, and the calm evening closes gently in. Is its appeal to you confined to its presentment of the past? Have you no share in this, but while the grace of youth, and the strong resolve of maturity are yours to aid you? Look up again. Look up where the spirit is enthroned, and see about her, reverend men, whose task is done, whose struggle is no more, who cluster round her as her train and counsel, who have lost no share or interest in that great rising up and progress, which bears upward with it every means of human happiness, but, true in autumn to the purposes of spring, are there to stimulate the race who follow in their steps, to contemplate, with hearts grown serious, not cold or sad, the striving in which they once had part, to die in that great presence, which is truth and bravery, and mercy to the weak, beyond all power of separation. It would be idle to observe of this last group that, both in execution and idea, they are of the very highest order of art, and wonderfully serve the purpose of the picture. There is not one among its 23 heads, of which the same remark might not be made. Neither will we treat of great effects produced by means quite powerless in other hands for such an end, or of the prodigious force and color which so separate this work from all the rest exhibited, that it would scarcely appear to be produced upon the same kind of surface by the same description of instrument. The bricks and stones and timbers of the hall itself are not facts more indisputable than these. It has been objected to this extraordinary work that it is too elaborately finished, too complete in its several parts. And heaven knows, if it be judged in this respect by any standard in the hall about it, it will find no parallel, nor anything approaching to it. But it is a design, intended to be afterwards copied and painted in fresco, and certain finish must be had at last, if not at first. It is very well, to take it for granted in a cartoon, that a series of cross lines, almost as rough, and apart as the lattice work of a garden summer house, represents the texture of a human face, but the face cannot be painted so. A smear upon the paper may be understood, by virtue of the context gained from what surrounds it, to stand for a limb, or a body, or a cuirass, or a hat and feathers, or a flag, or a boot, or an angel. But when the time arrives for rendering these things in colors on a wall, they must be grappled with, and cannot be slurred over in this wise. Great misapprehension on this head seems to have been engendered in the minds of some observers by the famous cartoons of Raffle, but they forget that these were never intended as designs for fresco painting. They were designed for tapestry work, which is susceptible of only certain broad and general effects, as no one better knew than the great master. Utterly detestable and vile as the tapestry is, compared with the immortal cartoons from which it was worked, it is impossible for any man who casts his eyes upon it, where it hangs at Rome, not to see immediately the special adaptation of the drawings to that end, and for that purpose. The aim of these cartoons being wholly different, Mr. McLeish's object, if we understand it, was to show precisely what he meant to do, and knew he could perform, in fresco, on a wall. And here his meaning is, worked out, without a compromise of any difficulty, without the avoidance of any disconcerting truth, expressed in all its beauty, strength, and power. To what end? To be perpetuated hereafter in the high place of the chief senate house of England? To be wrought, as it were, into the very elements of which that temple is composed? To co-endure with it, and still present, perhaps, some lingering traces of its ancient beauty, when London shall have sunk into a grave of grass-grown ruin, and the whole circle of the arts, another revolution of the mighty wheel completed, shall be wrecked and broken? Let us hope so. We will contemplate no other possibility at present. In memoriam W.M. Thackeray, it has been desired by some of the personal friends of the great English writer who established this magazine, 1, that its brief record of his having been stricken from among men, should be written by the old comrade and brother in arms who pens these lines, and of whom he often wrote himself, and always with the warmest generosity. I saw him first nearly 28 years ago, when he proposed to become the illustrator of my earliest book. I saw him last, shortly before Christmas, at the Athenaeum Club, when he told me that he had been in bed 3 days that, after these attacks, he was troubled with cold shiverings, which quite took the power of work out of him, and that he had it in his mind to try a new remedy which he laughingly described. He was very cheerful, and looked very bright. In the night of that day week, he died. The long interval between those two periods is marked in my remembrance of him by many occasions, when he was supremely humorous, when he was irresistibly extravagant, when he was softened and serious, when he was charming with children. But, by none do I recall him more tenderly than by two or three that start out of the crowd, when he unexpectedly presented himself in my room, announcing how that some passage in a certain book had made him cry yesterday, and how that he had come to dinner, because he couldn't help it, and must talk such passage over. No one can ever have seen him more genial, natural, cordial, fresh, and honestly impulsive, than I have seen him at those times. No one can be surer than I, of the greatness and the goodness of the heart that then disclosed itself. We had our differences of opinion. I thought that he too much feigned a want of earnestness, and that he made a pretense of undervaluing his art, which was not good for the art that he held in trust. But, when we fell upon these topics, it was never very gravely, and I have a lively image of him in my mind, twisting both his hands in his hair, and stamping about, laughing, to make an end of the discussion. When we were associated in remembrance of the late Mr. Douglas Jerrold, he delivered a public lecture in London, in the course of which, he read his very best contribution to Punch, describing the grown-up cares of a poor family of young children. No one hearing him could have doubted his natural gentleness, or his thoroughly unaffected manly sympathy with the weak and lowly. He read the paper most pathetically, and with a simplicity of tenderness that certainly moved one of his audience to tears. This was presently after his standing for Oxford, from which place he had dispatched his agent to me, with a droll note to which he afterwards added a verbal postscript, urging me to come down and make a speech, and tell him who he was, for he doubted whether more than two of the electors had ever heard of him, and he thought there might be as many as six or eight who had heard of me. He introduced the lecture just mentioned, with a reference to his late electioneering failure, which was full of good sense, good spirits, and good humor. He had a particular delight in boys, and an excellent way with them. I remember his once asking me with fantastic gravity, when he had been to Eton, where my eldest son then was, whether I felt as he did in regard of never seeing a boy without wanting instantly to give him a sovereign. I thought of this, when I looked down into his grave, after he was laid there, for I looked down into it over the shoulder of a boy to whom he had been kind. These are slight remembrances, but it is too little familiar things suggestive of the voice, look, manner, never, never more to be encountered on this earth, that the mind first turns in a bereavement. And greater things, that are known of him, in the way of his warm affections, his quiet endurance, his unselfish thoughtfulness for others, and his munificent hand, may not be told. If, in the reckless vivacity of his youth, his satirical pen had ever gone astray or done amiss, he had caused it to prefer its own petition for forgiveness, long before. I writ the foolish fancy of his brain, the aimless jest that, striking, hath caused pain, the idle word, that he'd wish back again. In no pages should I take it upon myself at this time to discourse of his books, of his refined knowledge of character, of his subtle acquaintance with the weaknesses of human nature, of his delightful playfulness as an essayist, of his quaint and touching ballads, of his mastery over the English language. Least of all, in these pages, enriched by his brilliant qualities from the first of the series, and beforehand accepted by the public through the strength of his great name. But, on the table before me, there lies all that he had written of his latest and last story. That it would be very sad to anyone, that it is inexpressibly so to a writer in its evidences of matured designs never to be accomplished, of intentions begun to be executed, and destined never to be completed, of careful preparation for long roads of thought that he was never to traverse, and for shining goals that he was never to reach, will be readily believed. The pain, however, that I have felt in perusing it, has not been deeper than the conviction that he was in the healthiest vigor of his powers when he wrought on this last labor. In respect of earnest feeling, far-seeing purpose, character, incident, and a certain loving picturesqueness blending the whole, I believe it to be much the best of all his works. That he fully meant it to be so, that he had become strongly attached to it, and that he bestowed great pains upon it, I trace in almost every page. It contains one picture which must have cost him extreme distress, and which is a masterpiece. There are two children in it, touched with a hand as loving and tender as ever a father caressed his little child with. There is some young love as pure, and innocent and pretty as the truth. And it is very remarkable that, by reason of the singular construction of the story, more than one main incident usually belonging to the end of such a fiction is anticipated in the beginning, and thus there is an approach to completeness in the fragment, as to the satisfaction of the reader's mind concerning the most interesting persons, which could hardly have been better attained, if the writer's breaking off had been foreseen. The last line he wrote, and the last proof he corrected, are among these papers through which I have so sorrowfully made my way. The condition of the little pages of manuscript, where death stopped his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.